Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's May 1st, 2014 7th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 12-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 8. William Young, Eamon Kallik, and Ethan Johnson will discuss Islamic fund products, Sharia law issues and marketing to the Middle East, and AIFMD. Now, on to the podcast.
William?
Thank you, Ethan. There before you is the Alternative Investment Fund Manager Directive Transposition Map. Green is good. That means the countries have implemented the directive. So that immediately gives you a feel for the fact that there is a lack of implementation, and the original deadline for that was last July. Let's look at how the AIFMD applies to you. You'll see on the slides acronyms like AIFIM, that means a manager, and an AIF means an alternative investment fund such as a hedge fund. So US managers which market funds to EU professional investors are covered, and US managers which manage EU funds will be covered from 2015. For those of you with EU affiliates or contemplating an EU setup, if you set up an EU manager, then you would be caught by the AIFM, and also if you marketed funds to EU professional investors, you would be caught too. So let's look at US AIFMs in particular. They may be given a passport to market funds to EU professional investors in 2015. If so, a US manager who wishes to use that would require to become fully authorized under the directive in its chosen member state of reference and comply with all the rules. A US manager which manages an EU fund will require to be authorized under the directive in its chosen member state of reference in 2015, whether or not it markets the fund in the EU. So that's a date to put in the diaries. However, US managers managing non-EU funds and not marketing them in the EU at all are not subject to the directive. There's a nice exemption for small managers. That basically, small means in relation to their assets under management. So a hedge fund managing under 100 million euros is exempt from the AIFMD. And there's an exemption you'll have heard of for reverse solicitation, which I'll touch on. And the directive applies to marketing, and marketing is defined, at least in the directive, as basically offering. However, some member states haven't implemented it that narrowly.
But this is just offering to professional investors, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's a good point, Ethan. This particular slide that just come up is meant to just clarify things for you. The AIFMD applies when marketing is restricted to professional investors only, and where the directive does not apply or there is an exemption, there'll still be a local private placement regime to govern promotion. Don't get confused with UCITS funds. UCITS funds are not covered by the AIFMD. They're the only type of fund that isn't covered by the AIFMD. And as you know, they can be promoted to retail investors throughout Europe, as well as professional investors. So what constitutes marketing? You can see that there at the slide. It's essentially a direct or indirect offering at the initiative of the manager or on behalf of the manager of units in the fund. The UK and Germany have implemented that definition as it is in the directive. Unfortunately, other member states have implemented a wider definition which would cover pre-marketing or soft marketing, where you're not actually making an offering. And that's causing confusion. So Denmark and the Netherlands are examples of that. Reverse solicitation is an interesting exemption from this marketing regime which affects you when you're targeting EU investors. So the directive doesn't affect the situation whereby a professional investor in the EU invests in the fund on its own initiative. That's been labelled reverse solicitation. A lot of US managers are relying on that, some very aggressively, some less aggressively, but you know, do be careful to check the local law of the EU member state for what that is and ensure you've got appropriate policies and procedures in place to create an audit trail for each reverse solicited investor.
William, I think you've explained that reverse solicitation really only applies to the fund manager itself. You can't hire, for example, a broker, dealer, or other placement agent in Europe to solicit on a reverse solicitation basis, right? Isn't that
No, absolutely not. The EU authorities are wise to that, and they basically issued a carve-out that says, if you're reverse listing purely to circumvent the directive, we will seek to unpick that. But the good news is, if you do rely on reverse solicitation, the directive doesn't apply at all. So none of this marketing regime would apply. And that's why it's such an attractive exemption. Any regulator in the EU to have given its thought to what reverse solicitation is and has said that a confirmation from the investor that the offering or placement of units in the fund was made at its initiative should normally be sufficient to demonstrate that this is the case, provided that is obtained before the offer or placement takes place. However, managers should not be able to rely upon that confirmation if this has been obtained to circumvent the requirements of AIFMD. So US managers may continue to market funds in the EU under private placement regimes, and they have been able to do that since last July. It's a bit strange, we've had this 1 year grace period, so all these provisions actually came into force last July, but with a 1 year grace period, which expires on the 21st of July this summer. This regime is now really biting in reality. The private placement overlay obliges managers to comply with transparency requirements and private equity requirements where necessary. And it also requires things which are beyond the control of managers, such as cooperation agreements for systemic risk oversight between the regulators of the states in which marketing is to occur, the third country of the manager, so that's the US, and the third country of the non-EU fund, could be Cayman or Delaware. Such cooperation agreements are in place between the CFTC, SEC, and each local regulator in the EU, bar with a few exceptions. Note that a mere US state-registered advisor would not be covered by those agreements.
This has caused us a lot of problems for our hedge fund advisors and others who are exempt under the private fund advisor exemption, so that there doesn't seem to be any solution for that.
And the bad news for them is that the AIFMD private placement overlay would lock the door on them or shut the door on them. And the other thing is the directive allows each member state to impose stricter requirements if it wishes. The UK hasn't done that, but Germany and Denmark are examples of countries which have. Finally, the private placement regimes may be abolished in 2018, just leaving the AIFMD passport route to marketing funds to EU professional investors, which would essentially mean US managers would have to become fully authorized under the directive with the regulator in the member state of reference, even though they don't have a place of business in that member state. Let's look at the transparency requirements. There's an annual report requirement, so nothing different there from your annual financial statements, bar the following. You'll see there in the second and third bullet points, the amount of remuneration for the financial year, split into fixed and variable, paid by the manager to its staff, must be disclosed. And the aggregate amount of remuneration broken down by senior management and members of staff of the manager whose actions have a material impact on the risk profile of the fund must be disclosed. That's highly contentious over here in the US, but it is a requirement. There are some pre-sale disclosures to investors to make, and we need those in particular for the offering materials. There are some disclosures which you wouldn't normally see in a PPM, for example, a description of procedures by which the fund may change its investment strategy or policy, the legal position on recognition and enforcement of court judgments. So essentially the solution there is to produce an AIFMD wrapper document which complies with the AIFMD disclosures.
You could wrap that into your existing PPM, but then you're burdening that PPM if you want to use it in other parts of the world, right?
Yeah. In talking to hedge fund managers, there are specific provisions on leverage. So those hedge fund managers employing leverage are subject to quite stringent disclosure requirements when marketing into the EU.
And again, it's just disclosure, no prohibitions at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. There is an Annex 4 reporting to regulators requirement for US managers marketing into the EU. And that is a significant thing. It's a project in itself. And the slides I just skipped through tell you more about that, but essentially it's quarterly reporting for a hedge fund manager to the regulator in every member state that it's targeting investors in. some useful takeaways here that you wouldn't otherwise have. Feeder funds, individual reports for feeder funds of the same master fund. No look through to holdings of the master fund. Fund of funds, there's no look through to holdings of underlying funds. So let's just look at some practical steps for access to the UK market. The US manager must give written notification to the UK FCA before marketing a fund it manages, confirming the manager's responsible for complying with AIFMD, and it complies with the requirements of AIFMD, and appropriate cooperation arrangements are in place. A US small manager must give written notification to FCA of a slightly shorter list of disclosures, so it's a bit easier for them, but they still have to make that. In both cases, simple notification is all you need to do, and once you've got an acknowledgement of receipt, you have consent to market in the UK. So it's very straightforward in the UK. Sadly, it is not as straightforward in certain other member states as it is in the UK. For example, in Germany and Denmark, you'll have to appoint a depository-type service provider to your fund in order to get permission. And with that, I shall wrap up my presentation and turn to Eamon.
So, Eamon, tell us a little bit about the current topics in your region.
When we actually started looking at what might be of interest to fund managers in particular, some institutional investors, and as far as the Middle East is concerned, I think two topics come to mind. One of them is the standard topic, which is how can I head to the Middle East and raise money from investors? It's a placement issue that you will encounter everywhere that overlaps with what William covered and what many of the speakers today have covered and will be covering after lunch. However, the one thing that stands out that does not overlap to a great extent with what we've heard, or to any extent actually, is whether that investor you're going to see will insist that the fund or whatever securities that are being marketed to the institution are compliant with Sharia or Islamic law. And what does this mean in practice? How do we basically link this to some of the trends we're seeing outside the Middle East? You know, recently a number of funds have been promoting the ethical component of investing. They are basically shying away from investing in certain sectors. They're focusing on certain ethical, sustainable investments with a social mission. And that would be sort of the starting point in trying to understand what Islamic investors would want. One mistake that people make is that they assume that by going to the Middle East and by meeting investors, then by default, those investors would want the securities to be compliant with Islamic law or Sharia. That's not necessarily the case. In fact, McKinsey had done a study some time ago to see what investors in the broader Middle East region want. And it turned out that there is around 20% that will only invest in compliance with Islamic law, even if it means they're going to lose money on the investment, even if the product is more expensive. And there is a similar percentage that wouldn't invest in compliance with Islamic law because they're secular and they distinguish between their investments and their religious lives. And then there is that 60% majority that said, okay, if you present this with a product that is as competitive from a structuring point of view, from a cost point of view, from a return point of view to the conventional product, then our preference is to go with the Islamic choice, but subject to those conditions. So it is yes, but. And that's the investor base that most fund managers are trying to focus on. So in practice, what does this mean? It means that there are industries that are prohibited. I mean, and that's the key list of prohibited industries. Now, if you look at many of the ethical funds actually have much longer lists of prohibitions. And this one is like the basic prohibitions that you need to be aware of. Now, some of those actually are straightforward because there's big overlap with ethical funds, including alcohol, pornography, and certain entertainment. That's definitely out. However, financial services, what do you do with that? From an Islamic point of view, you can't invest in a financial institution that is not compliant with Islamic law. So banks and insurance companies are out. So the universe of securities available to you is limited. And I've had cases where I was told, okay, that list is straightforward. We can implement, you know, those fairly easily, and we can do a filter, and we can figure it out. It's not always as easy. For example, if you're investing in a hotel, perfect. It's Sharia compliant. You know, it's providing a service. But if it has a bar, how do you actually draw the line between the income generated from renting out the rooms from the income generated from the operations of the bar, for example. So that's one consideration to keep in mind. So it's not always an easy distinction. But the one area where things get tricky is the debt ratio, where the rule of thumb is you can't invest in a company if the borrowings and debt of that company exceeds one-third of its assets or market cap if it's listed, which maybe it's less relevant here, but for the private equity industry, that kills most deals because the debt usually is considerably higher than the assets of the company or the market cap of the company, especially in leveraged buyouts. But also many companies have debt that are more than one-third of its total capital. And the reason behind this rule is that from an Islamic finance point of view, it's a combination of sectors that are prohibited and financial prudence rules, which is a rule that says, you know, you need to invest in companies that are financially prudent and where your investment is not in a very risky asset. So whereas we have other rules like the interest income ratio of, you know, you can't earn more than 5% in interest, the one that is the trickiest is the debt ratio. And that's where most of the structuring work is, most of the time is spent on structuring it in a way that we can get around this rule. And, you know, this is becoming a little bit, I wouldn't say mainstream, but it's not new to say, for example, in the UK. If you go to the index and you type Islamic index, you'll find that they apply a filter, a separate filter that applies all these rules to the list of companies that are listed on the or the stocks and pick those that are compliant with Sharia to make it easier for investors who are actually interested in investing from that point of view to pick the stocks that can be deemed compliant with Sharia. They do this on a monthly basis, and they have a board that reviews all of this to make sure it is compliant. And the same is with... So what are the key differences with conventional funds? I often say that, you know, 80% of the structure, the documentation is identical to conventional funds. It's the same issues we look at. Tax issues, structuring issues, licensing, regulatory issues. You need to go through the same list. But then we have to add an extra layer, which is a compliance layer. We need someone to come in and verify that that investment is compliant with Islamic law. In many countries, that's not a requirement, even Middle Eastern countries. If you want to invest conventionally and in a standard fund, that's up to you. If you want to invest in a product that is compliant with Islamic law, then you need to have that one paper that's called an Islamic compliance certificate. Who will issue that? It's basically a number of scholars who actually have the experience and the knowledge and the know-how to be able to issue that certificate. The problem is there's no one unified institution or organization that basically licenses or regulates or issues qualifications to those scholars. It becomes something akin to forum shopping for us as lawyers, because you have to choose the ones who are most acceptable to your investor base. For example, if you are marketing securities in Saudi Arabia, chances are, if your scholar is from Malaysia, that is often viewed as more liberal, open-minded, and flexible in implementing certain Islamic finance rules, then that becomes sort of a weakness in your offering. So, you know, this is often the case that you are forming a board that can relate to the needs and requirements of your investor base. In most cases, the scholars, I often refer to them as rock stars because there aren't many of them. And they're in demand and, you know, you need to find them, you need to get them to review the documents, and they need to give you comments that are workable. So by definition, you need those who have some economics training, some financial training, who can actually communicate in English and review documents in English, because if you need to translate each and every time, you have a suite of documents that becomes basically prohibitive. So that would be the key difference. But from structuring the management, the investment management relationship, whereas there are some terms, and don't worry about those terms in blue, but I had to show off a little bit. Putting those terms aside, this is investment management relationship, okay? It has terms that can go back to Islamic law, but these are equivalent terms. You don't have to give your contract a fancy name for it to be compliant. It's just the structure of the management arrangement that matters the most. Now, some ways to get around this. Some asset managers would come in and say, okay, listen, I'm not going to change the structure of my entire fund just because there's interest from these two, three, four investors in the Middle East who are interested in investing in my fund, and they're asking that I actually Islamize my fund when I have all these investors from all over the world, including the US, who can make this happen. So the answer to this question is to either create parallel funds where you have a separate entity for the Islamic investors that's totally separate from the conventional fund and where they have opt-out rights, in certain cases where the investments are not compliant, or you do a feeder fund, and this is where the opt-out becomes more relevant, because in that case, what you're saying, that is all the Islamic investors would come in under the banner of that one feeder fund, and then that one feeder fund is going to co-invest with your LPs or your investors, and to the extent that some of your investments are not compliant, they have the right to opt out of that investment, which means their returns will not be identical, could be better or worse, but at least this way, you're not commingling the two funds or the two investment guidelines, given that you have an extra set of investment guidelines in the case of the Islamic fund. So then you see some issues on the screen that you will have to face when structuring Islamic funds. Limited diversification is one, because your investment universe is smaller. Marketing obstacles, you know, there's a perception that the returns are going to be lower in that case. Requirement to dispose assets at a loss, that's a situation you may face. If, for example, you buy a stock that's compliant today, and a few months down the line, the company takes on debt that is higher than 1-3, and then you have to dispose of that asset, then that might become a fire sale situation where you can lose money. There are ways to get around this, but usually they entail sitting with the scholars and agreeing an exit plan that makes sense to the investors. They are often willing to work through these issues, but you need to be aware of them.
Do the scholars charge a fee for that?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a retainer, and sometimes you have, you know, per meeting, even some of the big financial institutions in the U.S., they have boards of scholars who are retained on an annual basis to review the products, because the last thing you want is to start looking to appoint them when you have a product and you have an investor and you need to structure it quickly. That becomes distracting. So many of the big players actually have the scholars retained. So these are some of the key issues. And if you look at this slide, I mean, it's a normal fund. There's nothing to it that's more than what you would see in any fund. But if you look at the two blocks in yellow, those are where the Sharia scholars would come in. So to me, it's an extra layer of regulation that you need to deal with. That's the gist of it. It's an extra layer of regulation, extra operations or monitoring that you need to apply in that context. And so long as you have those retained on day one and they issued a certificate saying that the structure and the documentation as drafted are compliant, then you are good to go and you can target those investors in the Middle East.
Ayman, would you say that you see variations among the different countries as to whether the percentage of investors who want a Sharia-compliant fund, you know, looking from Turkey to Malaysia to...
It's a good question. I mean, there's a misconception that most Arab countries, for example, are strict on applying Islamic law, which is not necessarily the case, even where there was demand. In fact, even if you go to the Gulf countries, a country like Oman, for the longest time, actually had no Islamic law. And it was frowned upon for some reason, because for them the banking sector was totally separate until a couple of years ago. Of course, Saudi Arabia has long heritage, Kuwait has long heritage in Islamic law. Countries like Turkey, because of the secular nature of the country, there's always been that tension between applying Islamic law to financial dealings and the secular nature of the constitution. And there, they refer to it as participating or participation, like sort of the participation model as opposed to calling it the Islamic finance model, just to get over that perception. Malaysia tends to be almost 100% Islamic in terms of the dealings, but I have to say they've come along a very, very long way in terms of adopting the Western products and reintroducing them in a compliant way, especially on the capital market side and on the fund side. So basically that's one thing that you probably need to be aware of its existence. If there's something to remember, or like one or two things to remember from the slides we went through, is that this is akin to ethical investment with a financial prudence component in terms of which companies you can invest in. To the extent that you feel there is demand in your products, then there is a way, or there are ways, to structure separate entities on a feeder fund basis or parallel fund basis to attract those investors without having to change the overall structure that the rest of your investor base is used to. But that's sort of one consideration. Of course, there's then the consideration of how do you go about actually selling those funds in the various countries. And that becomes an issue again of selling securities and securities regulations in the various jurisdictions. You will see in your material that we try to give you some information on three key jurisdictions where, from our experience, most foreign fund managers coming from the US, EU, and sometimes, you know, Asia, and those countries are the UAE, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. And you will see that most of these countries, there is a high level of regulation, at least on paper, in terms of what you can and cannot do. And that has gone through different variations of what can be done. For example, 10 years ago, you can basically fly in and schedule meetings with a number of institutional and sophisticated investors. And of course, the definition of a sophisticated investor was not clear. 10 years ago in Saudi Arabia, an institutional investor was deemed to be sophisticated just by virtue of it being an institution. But no one would give you that ruling in writing. So you can talk to the regulator and they'd say, yes, that's fine, but you will never get it in writing. But that changed completely now. Changed completely into Saudi Arabia being today probably the strictest regulation in the broader Middle East or strictest jurisdiction in terms of what you can and cannot do. And basically, and simply put, you need to appoint a local placement agent. There's no way around it. And that placement agent has to have a certain license because the bank account needs to be opened in the country and the money needs to flow through that bank account, which means that whoever is managing that bank account needs to have an investment management license. So a straightforward placement agent who just introduces you to some investors would not work, even if they have that license to do so. You need to have an investment management license because that bank account is akin to a feeder fund, given the aggregation of investors' monies. It's a different issue if someone flies out to see you somewhere else and they invest in your business, because there are some families that have been investing for tens and tens of years and probably their meetings are held in London or New York more so than in Jeddah or Riyadh. But if you are coming into the country, then the expectation is that you're going to appoint a local placement agent. If we take it a step further, you look at Kuwait, for example. It's another country that has a long heritage of investing abroad in real estate and securities in the Western world in particular. But in the last 2 years, 3 years, the whole landscape has changed. And now there's a capital markets authority, and you need to get an approval to market your product in the country if you are to actually meet with the investors. And that approval takes a long time actually to be issued, and in many cases won't be issued. So you're better off again appointing a local placement agent and being a local institution. Some of the outfits, even in New York, and I'm aware of a number of those cases, actually follow the route of a white label. They white label a fund for distribution by a bank on an exclusive basis or non-exclusive basis in countries like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and other places. And that works across the two jurisdictions.
Would those be organized abroad, or would they have to be organized in Saudi or...
In the case of Kuwait and a number of jurisdictions, and the UAE, for example, organized abroad would be fine. In Saudi Arabia, by law, it will be fine, but by practice, because you will need to open that local bank account, and that local bank account is treated as a feeder fund that needs to be approved by the regulator, it's a blurred distinction in a way. And there is the reverse solicitation discussion that William had tried to tackle. That comes into play as well. But no one is going to give you a straight answer as to whether it works or not, especially the regulator. Because what you're telling the regulator is, okay, if we find a way to show that somebody contacted us in the first place, okay, how did you get to know them? Oh, well, we had marketed to them some years ago. The question is, where do you stop? You know, how far back can you go? I think the UAE has come a long, long way in terms of fixing some of the issues relating to the general ease by which fund managers found it to approach investors from the UAE and in the UAE. So long as they were sophisticated, they had invested abroad before, it was fine in a way, and the regulator would not interfere. But now they made it stricter, but they came up with regulations a couple of years ago that didn't really work in practice. And to give them credit, they listened to the industry and they came up with amendments in 2013 that made it much easier for fund managers to target directly sovereign wealth funds. Because the argument was, those sovereign wealth funds are formed specifically to invest in securities in the country and outside the country. Why do you need to go through a placement agent to actually approach them when their teams are probably stronger than most of the local banks? And that was one exemption. And those very also securities companies, the banks being one category, and those who have a license to manage third-party funds were also given an exemption where you can target them directly. And again, we have the reverse solicitation discussion also applicable in Kuwait. So as you can see, it's a shifting tide, but if there are two things to remember, as I said, is that some of the investors are going to want the product to be Sharia compliant, and we covered that, and then you need to also look into how you can approach those investors in the first place.
Eamon and William, thank you very much. Very interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2014 7th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit PodcastCentral at morganlewis.com. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefundsresources.